Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Dan Gunning. Every Tuesday, we bring you a special program selected from the club's many weekly presentations. These broadcasts are recorded for the listeners of KALW 91.7 Information Radio in San Francisco. Today's presentation was recorded on March 3rd and was underwritten by the people of Chevron. And now, here is Rosemary Wright to introduce today's speaker.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. This program is brought to you from the club's office in downtown San Francisco. I am Rosemary Wright, chair of the personal growth section, and your chair for this evening. We also welcome our radio listeners and invite all of you here and on the radio to visit us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. Tonight's program, The Pursuit of Happiness, is the first of four in our Monday night philosophy series. Join us here at the club's office on Monday, April 7th, for The Patterns of Our Emotions, on Monday, May 5th, for Intelligent Desiring, and on Monday, June 2nd, for the final First Monday lecture in this series, The Inherent Justice of Life. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished guest, George Hammond. He is the author of Conversations with Socrates and three other philosophical books on issues on theoretical physics, early Christianity, and rational idealism. He is also the author of three novels and a collection of short stories. Mr. Hammond has told me that he is fortunate he has not attempted to earn a living with these interests. George Hammond is an international mergers and acquisitions lawyer and is on the board of governors of the Pacific Stock Exchange. He graduated from Dartmouth in Russian literature and received his law degree from the University of Wisconsin. Please help me in welcoming to our Commonwealth Club podium tonight, George Hammond.
For those of you who heard the summer preview last year, I welcome you back. The lectures are always slightly different, and tonight I'd like to talk about the pursuit of happiness again. Now, obviously this is something that everybody thinks about some of the time. What is the slightly different approach that I'm going to take? First, I'd like to talk a little bit about the history of how I got interested in this and where the basic ideas are coming from, where I have a slightly different angle on something that people have talked about for thousands of years. One is, the background is Pythagorean, actually, and Plato. My book, Conversations with Socrates, I took Plato and had him go to the Isles of the Blessed after he died. That's the Greek heaven of the time. And he was looking for Socrates to start up his conversations again. Plato's idea about happiness, if you asked him, what is your best image of happiness that you could have? His image of happiness was to go to the Isles of the Blessed and to have all the philosophers in the world there to talk with all the time. And this is exactly what he thought heaven would be like. Obviously, everybody has a different idea of heaven, but that's a philosopher's idea of heaven. And so to take the idea immediately and show that he was wrong about that, at the start of my book, I have him go, and nobody has heard of anybody who's a philosopher when he gets to the gates of the Isles of the Blessed. And no one has heard of Socrates, but he goes into the town square, and he finds Socrates talking to two or three other people, the usual. After 50 years, he's got two or three people interested. So that's the background of the story, and then I have Plato and Socrates and these other three people discuss their issues all over again, the concepts of virtue, justice, happiness, and can we define them? Now, it probably sounds a little bit strange, this Platonic obsession with defining things, but that's because we live in a world where everything is defined, and many of you are lawyers, you know everything is defined in great detail in every document. And we have come to learn to live with something and take for granted something, which really was not the way people thought about things 2,500 years ago. And that is to have a concept, to have a defined term, a defined way of looking at something, an idea. Most people thought in images. Most people still think in images. That's why movies are so popular and why, even if the movie doesn't make any sense from a logical point of view, one image after another can carry you along very quickly, unless you're thinking at the same time the images are carrying you along and saying, I don't believe that. So the suspension of disbelief in a movie is pretty easy when you're bombarded by a tremendous number of images. But this is about as close as in modern life we can get to, I think, the way most people lived 2,500 years ago and thought. Now, not everybody. There always was logic. There always was a reasonable approach to some things. But the thinking about the big picture, about life itself, this was not really engaged in. The man that pretty much changed that, a man named Pythagoras. Now, our idea about Pythagoras is pretty vague. People think of him as a magician. People think of him as the author of the Pythagorean theorem, which is mathematics. There's all kinds of mythological stories told about him. He's a very unusual figure in history, in the history of science, but that's because he was one of the first people that did this. And obviously, the first amphibious animal leaving the ocean will come out wet. Pythagoras stepped out of the ocean of myth, and he certainly had a lot of myth involved, but he had a different approach to things. And it was very interesting how he did it. He basically saw a couple of things. He observed a couple of things and got very excited because they were useful things. One of those observations was that harmonics in music is caused by a direct mathematical relationship. A string that is exactly twice as long as another string creates exactly the same sound but at a different octave. And this is the start of Western music. There was not this, you know, set of octaves before that mathematical relationship was understood. He was very excited about that. In addition to that, what he's famous for, among other things, is the Pythagorean theorem. Now, the Egyptians had already discovered that if you had three sides to a triangle, a right triangle, that the one side was twice, the total area was twice what it was on the other two sides. That was known. But it wasn't formulated in any kind of clear way. It was just used in practice. And Pythagoras noticed that a squared plus b squared equals c squared. That you could say this in a very concise, direct way. It's an idea, a concept. And so, sort of at the beginning of concepts, he got all excited, and like a lot of people when they invent something or see something new, like the dot-com boom a few years ago, this is going to take over everything. This is going to explain everything. This is going to revolutionize everything. And so he came to the conclusion that all is number. What kind of got in his way was when he figured out, according to his own theorem, that there is no clear number. When you have a one on one side of a square, one on the other side, what is the measurement of the other side? And it's the square root of 2. It's not an exact number. Cause problems because everything should be number. Same thing is true about pi. Actually, I use pi because it's a very interesting mathematical tool that was used by the ancient Greeks. It's the number 3.14 and it just goes on forever. But it is the exact relationship between the circumference and the diameter of a circle. And so there's a relationship there. And that relationship can be described, but it isn't described perfectly. It's described precisely. And you cannot nail it down, but you can talk about the relationship of one concept to another concept, and you can do it precisely mathematically. So Pythagoras was very excited. Everything is number. And then he had, in his own investigations, discovered that that's probably not going to be true. Where it went from there was a lot of mathematicians were excited by what Pythagoras did. There are a lot of great mathematical advances. It's pretty hard to figure out who did what at the time and what Pythagoras did, what other people did, but it doesn't really matter. But Plato lived about 150 years later. And in addition to the logic classes which he got from Socrates, he had another idea, and that is that everything is an imperfect copy of what is perfect. And what is perfect is an eternal idea. He took the idea of number. He was a Pythagorean himself. He took the idea of that all is number, and he made it a little bit more abstract. And he tried to define what these eternal ideas were. Happiness is one of them. That's what we're going to do tonight. We're going to try to take this, and we're going to try to see how, at the start of Greek philosophy, people looked at a concept in a rather admiring and overwhelming way because it was a rather new thing, and it was extremely useful. Now we're very used to it. And I think we can kind of get an idea about what this concept can do more effectively than the way that they approach the idea. Now we can come to a much better definition. Now, why does that? Well, Plato essentially looked ahead and he said, what is happiness? And he was not much different, actually, than the boy that says happiness is an ice cream cone, or the girl that says happiness is a Barbie doll, or the man who says it's a red convertible. Any of those concepts is part of what happiness is, but that's not what defines happiness, because happiness has a large number of different components, and what can we say is in common to all of them? That's really the nub of trying to come to a definition. And what Plato did was not quite that. He sort of defined what it was that would make him happy. In fact, not even what would make him happy, but when he became a really good person, it would make him happy. And so he looked out ahead of himself, and he projected what he would like to be like, and then he said, this is what would make me happy if I became as good as I hope to be. And he started defining things in terms of this perfection. Perfect concepts, perfect ideas, these eternal ideas, and this world is an imperfect copy. Now, he's very famous for an analogy, which is the analogy of the cave. And in this cave, all people see are the vague, shadowy images of what's going on outside. They're sitting in the cave, the sun comes through the light, the hole in the cave, and they have their back to the light, and they see projected on the wall these images. And basically he said that that is what people see in life, and that what's really true in life is if you get up and go out of the cave and you see the sunshine, and then everything becomes clear. Well, very similar analogy has been used in a large number of times by a large number of people. But the concept is basically, we live in a lousy place, and there's got to be a good place someplace, because life can't just be this lousy place where all the lousy things happen. Now, in his approach, in trying to create this perfect world in which he was, now why was he doing that? A lot of people haven't spent their lives, and he basically spent his whole life doing this once Socrates had died, trying to figure out how you could make life completely better, how you could eliminate all the problems in life. People want to eliminate their own particular problems, but not a lot of people spend a lot of time trying to eliminate all problems in life. Why? Why do we do those things? We want to make ourselves comfortable. Right? And to make ourselves comfortable, we want the surroundings to be like us. That is, if we like ourselves, and we want them to be completely different than ourselves if we don't like ourselves. So there's, completely, and obviously people both like and dislike themselves, and therefore they surround themselves both with things that they like and things that they don't like. So it's very complicated, but the principle is fairly simple. And that's all Plato was doing on a grand scale with his philosophy. He was trying to create a world that he would feel comfortable living in. Now, a lot of people read The Republic, and they say, I could never live there. That sounds like a totalitarian state, or it sounds very repressive, so on. But it depends on how you read it, depends on the time, depends on what it was, compared to. If they did not have a society like ours today, where people were pretty much free to think what they wanted to. So it was an advance. And one of the things that Pythagoras was and Plato both were a great advance on were women. They treated women equally, relatively unheard of concept at the time. Now, in this pursuit, from Plato's point of view, he took this concept of the eternal ideas and said, this is what is perfect. And we are an imperfect copy of that. There is a perfect idea of man, and all the men are imperfect copies of that in different ways. There's a perfect idea of woman, and all women are an imperfect copy of that in some ways. Not too much different than what Hollywood tries to do for us. And the problem with that is that when you then go to try to define happiness, you're defining it in terms of these perfect concepts. So the one thing that I'd like to talk about just before we get to the possibility of this definition is, why is it that happiness doesn't have a better reputation? Now, obviously, the pursuit of happiness is something that everybody either says, of course, that's what I do, or they say, yeah, I really am a little embarrassed about it, but I do it, or they try to resist it altogether. Because, why? They think that to be a good person, you can't pursue happiness. Where'd they get that idea from? Obviously, someone told them, or somewhere in the culture there is an idea that to be a good person, you really can't be a happy person. You can't really pursue happiness because there's too much trouble in the world. You don't have enough fellow feeling for the people who are suffering. One concept or another has influenced people to think that the pursuit of happiness is problematic, even though we all want to do it. Now, it's a very interesting phenomenon because most people have, and this is a slight digression into psychology, but most people have a very convoluted concept of who they are, a very complicated concept of who they are. And where do we get that from? Everybody around us is always kind of telling us, either verbally or subtly or, you know, totally unspoken but still there, to be a little different than we actually are. And everybody has a slightly different opinion. You're too thin, you're too fat, you're too tall, you don't have enough hair, your nose is a little too big, you talk too loud, you talk too softly. You know, there's just, everybody has a sort of different viewpoint. If you've ever been on a committee hiring people, you'll know, you know, well, one person says, well, that person was a little too quiet, and then the real quiet person says, quiet's good. So you really have a completely different viewpoint on all these issues, and we, you know, as I said, if we really like ourselves or those parts of ourselves, we wish everybody else sort of had that. And if we don't like it, then we wish everybody would be slightly different in that way. And so, although, as I said, the principle is very simple, but it gets very, very complicated in practice. And so we walk around always being told one way or another on a daily basis from 50 to 100 people that we're not exactly the way they want us to be. Now, why do they want us to be different than we are? Another very interesting question. Why are we walking around spending all that effort on a hopeless endeavor? Because people are not changing the way we're asking them to. Anybody who's spent their entire life being a parent knows that. This is not a process that really is a worthwhile endeavor if we are trying to pursue happiness and trying to get a desire fulfilled, and yet we do it all the time. So why do we do it? Because we are actually pursuing happiness. We think in our minds that if people were just a little different, we'd feel a lot better about ourselves. A very interesting side point like that is it's just one of those great ironies about the way we do this. If you actually finally convince somebody that they should see you exactly as you want them to see you, even though that's not the truth, you immediately dismiss their opinion as obviously unfounded. You could work at this for a long time with someone, trying to get them to see you. You project an image for them, either at work or in a relationship. You work hard to get them to see you exactly the way you want, and if they finally start to get it, as people say, and they start to see you exactly that way, you begin to totally dismiss their, obviously those people, that one doesn't know what he's talking about because that's not who I really am. And yet we pursue this all the time anyway because we are trying to see ourselves exactly the way we're trying to project to other people. And so we're trying to gain confidence by getting them to tell us what we want them to tell us. And ironically, when they ever get around to doing it, we know that we can't believe it because we know what the truth is. So that is one part of all the complications that are going on, and that's why in our culture we have a sort of reluctance to accept the pursuit of happiness as a noble goal. How many people would say it's a noble goal? But actually, it's quite a noble goal. We'll talk about that probably even more the next time. But this reputation is due to the fact of how we understand happiness to be. Now, the big complication is a lot of people say that kind of happiness isn't anything like the kind of happiness I have. And that's where the whole issue comes in on how to define happiness. So let's try, now in spite of that reputation, let's try to come up with what it is that's common in all forms of happiness. Because instead of trying to set our ideal way out in front of us, let's be realistic for a while and say, this is what our lives are really like. This is what our desires are really like. This is what we really pursue. And I'm going to deal with happiness tonight and not really unhappiness. Unhappiness is not the opposite. That's another very interesting idea that the Greeks had. They thought that the whole world existed because of the tension between the coexistence of opposites. And they considered happiness and unhappiness opposites. But they're not actually opposite at all. They're just two very different emotions that are very similar with only one element different. and we'll get to that a little bit later. We don't talk about the avoidance of pain, which is the other big motivator in life, but let's talk about the pursuit of pleasure. Now, if you take an experience that's very, very much the same, but you have a very different emotional reaction to it each time. Let's take the experience of a five-year-old girl. She's just gotten a doll that she's been asking for because it was advertised on TV. And so she really wanted it. She finally has it, but she has two older brothers. And anybody that, you know, has been at a Christmas where a five-year-old sister opens up a, you know, doll package knows what happens with the older brothers within the first 10 minutes. In the first 10 minutes, the head of the doll is gone. You know, this it has been decapitated. Now, obviously, the five-year-old is very, very upset. She's very unhappy. She's experienced quite a bit of pain. And this experience transforms itself in terms of its quality over time with a different experience. Say she's 12 years old now. Now, that doll's head's been put back on, sort of taped. You know, it's not quite up to snuff, but she's kept that doll. She played with it a lot. She really liked it. She's never quite gotten over the initial experience of it, but it's an important part of her life. And her younger brother comes into her doll collection one day while she's at school and rips all the heads off. Okay? Now, she comes home from school and she sees all that doll collection with the heads scattered all over the place, and she says, she's not happy, but it's not as traumatic an experience as it was when she was 5 years old. It's no longer as important to her at 12 because her desires are moving in a different direction. Now she's 23 years old. And she takes the doll collection that she has, she puts it in a box, she thinks about all these experiences, she has a sort of nostalgic mix of happiness and unhappiness over these experiences. She puts them aside and puts them in the attic, and then a year or two later she gets married, and then she has her first child, a daughter. And at about 3 years of age of the daughter, she remembers that box of dolls, and she brings them all out. She wants her daughter to have this experience. Of course, the daughter has an older brother too. And so the daughter takes out all these dolls, and then that older brother comes and rips all the heads off. Now I'm talking about the mother. The mother watches the whole experience over again, but from a totally different point of view again. She feels her daughter's pain. She feels her own pain. She feels everything, but again, there's a completely different quality to the emotional experience. Okay? Now, if you just boiled it down and said, this woman had a desire. The desire was, I don't want my doll's heads ripped off by anybody. It would never change. The emotional experience would never change from one to the other, but it always changes. Why? Because what's really going on is not too much about the doll's head, but has to do with a large number of other desires that we have that are our motives. And those motives are actually our real desires. And we'll go back to that later. But that's part of the complication of trying to figure out what is in common with all forms of happiness, is that a lot of things are actually desires that we have that produce happiness in us that we don't really recognize as desires directly. I'll give you a good example. Say you're particularly susceptible to advertising, and you're watching a football game someday, and you see a Mercedes-Benz advertised. And, of course, in the picture in the Mercedes-Benz, there is a young, beautiful woman that comes with the car. And in addition to that, all your neighbors are watching you as you drive by in your Mercedes with looks of great jealousy on their faces. So you get the idea, maybe I should go out and buy a Mercedes, but you don't really know why. Well, the advertisement also told you that this was a very safe car and that it would be very good for your family and to protect your family to have this car and so on and so forth. So you have that desire. You have the desire to make your neighbor jealous. You have the desire, you know, to get that woman that was in the advertisement, even though you don't really, you know, have that as a very clear idea because somehow you realize that really doesn't come as part of the package. And you have other desires as well that have to do with this. And you probably have 20 or 30 motives for wanting that Mercedes, not just the one or two that you're aware of. So you go out and buy the Mercedes, and you're driving it home, and you've already realized that the woman doesn't come with a car. But you go right by your neighbor's house, and you kind of accidentally put on the brake and stop because he's in the driveway washing his car. And you just kind of lean out the window, how are you doing today? Oh, I see you have a new car. Oh, you've got a Mercedes, that's too bad. BMWs are much better. And that ruins your pleasure, doesn't it? It ruins your pleasure. And you don't even care whether it's a Mercedes or BMW. It's just that your neighbor thinks that. And you didn't know that before you went out and bought it. Now, once you get the car home, you have probably satisfied 5, 10, 15 of the desires that are involved. And now you feel like you're keep protecting your family and a bunch of other things. You probably also feel a pinch in your bank account, but that's another thing. But you did not get what you wanted from your neighbor, in spite of the ad telling you that that's what you'd get. So you feel unhappy about that, and you feel happy about the other thing. And that's why unalloyed happiness does not happen too often. Because you have 20, 30, 40, 50 motives for almost everything that you think you're pursuing. And it's almost never possible to get all those motives satisfied at the same time. Some of them win, some of them lose, and it depends on how important they are to you that makes the difference of what you feel when you're done. So that's another part of trying to figure out what the definition of happiness is, to understand that motives are also desires, because, as I'm sure you've guessed by now, desire has a big part to play in the definition of happiness. Now, if you thought about it for just a second, can you think of anything at all, that you desire, that you don't desire, because you think it'll make you happy? Very often, people will say, I don't want to go to heaven to be happy. I want to go to heaven because that's what I'm supposed to do. Or that is what my purpose in life is. Or, I'm going to go to Asia. I don't want to gain nirvana because it's going to make me happy. I want to gain nirvana because that's my purpose in life. Or, I don't want to go to Las Vegas to make $1 million to make myself happy. I just want to go and prove that all the guys in Las Vegas don't know what they're doing and that I can beat them. And we can go on in a large number of different ways. But if you would boil each of them down, you would find there's only one reason why you want to get to nirvana, or you want to go to heaven, or you want to go to Las Vegas and beat them. And that is because somewhere underneath, you think, you imagine in your own mind, that you will be happier if you get that than if you don't have it. Now, you might not even think, if you study Buddhist writings clearly, that there is any concrete form of happiness that goes with nirvana. But you do know, he said, that that is a desirable goal. Now, if you study Buddha, you also know that he said desire is the root of all suffering. Now, what's interesting about that is, in coming to the conclusion that you would want to desire to not have any desires, if you actually achieve in your own mind that you don't have any desires, that's fulfilling a desire. It's the desire to have no desires. And so you have the quality of happiness that you get from thinking in your own mind that you have achieved this. And that is actually the happiness that's created by what's called nirvana. And it's a different quality of happiness because it's a different kind of desire. So if we look at all the different forms of happiness and all the different forms of desire, I think you'll find there's no action that is not motivated, no desire that's not motivated by the pursuit of happiness or by the avoidance of pain. But it's much more complicated than that because there's the issue of quality, as I've read before. And many people have said to me, but that's simple. I'm just going to desire every minute to eat a graham cracker. And then I'll just be able to eat one graham cracker after another. That's fairly easy to accomplish. And I will always be happy, continuously happy, and therefore I will achieve, you know, my pursuit of happiness. But it's not quite that simple, because the quality of eating a graham cracker, especially on your 1,000th month, is going to change quite dramatically as time goes on. And it will not create the happiness you're looking for, but other things might. So, what are the components of happiness? The first thing is that it's an emotion. Nice and simple. There are many other emotions, unhappiness being one of them. But emotion is what? Emotion I define as your automatic mental reactions. You automatically mentally react to things. And they come in a large number of variety of qualities. And next month, the lecture is on the patterns in our emotions, because there's a logic behind our emotion. There's a pattern behind our emotions that is often not understood as well. And as an aside, reason to use reason to try to understand these things is unusual, but because people just sort of accept this and say, in the 20th century, actually, scientists have taken emotion, taken other things and said, we can't study that, there's no logic to it, there's no pattern to it, it's irrational, and therefore, we don't even believe it's part of life. We think that, you know, it's all based upon chemicals in your system, hormones in your system, genes, something we can measure is what it's based on. But actually, there are clear patterns in our emotions, and my analogy for figuring them out is very simple. If you, one of the things in 20th century science is that we have to be able to measure something in order to know it. That's sort of one of the basic concepts and beliefs, actually, of 20th century science. But it's not that simple. It's never been that simple. If you go back to the people who figured out that the Earth wasn't flat, they didn't figure that out just based on their sense perceptions, just perceiving, measuring, because everywhere you looked, the Earth looked flat. And if you didn't have rockets and planes to go up and see what was actually going on, you just looked around you and all your sense impressions told you the same thing, the Earth is flat, and that if we take our ships out too far, we'll go off the edge of the ocean and fall out, because what else could it be? Well, there were a few people, and again, it's only sense perception, but their minds had to put the sense perceptions together. Sense perception, what they noticed was that there were certain kind of shadows at midday, and there were certain kind of shadows at other parts of the day. The Earth, the Sun was a circle, or maybe a sphere when they figured it out later on, and that it cast these certain shadows in a way which must mean that they are standing on the surface of a sphere themselves. The amount of information that was available to their senses that contradicted the idea that the Earth was flat was less than 1% of what they saw. And almost everybody was quite happy with this other observation. But it took people who said, these observations don't fit the pattern that we think is there, and put all the pieces of information back together again in another way that then said, this only makes sense if I'm standing on a sphere and the Sun is also a sphere and so is the Moon. Of course, then that information was ignored for another 600 or 700 years, maybe 1,400 years. But that's all right. It was something that a few people figured out from their sense perceptions, but organized by what? Organized into a coherent pattern. What does that? Your mind does that, if you let it. So in this case, we're going to try to organize all our experiences of happiness into a coherent pattern, and it's pretty simple. Emotions. It's an emotion, and it's caused by the fulfillment of a desire. Right? Now, as I mentioned earlier, unhappiness is just slightly different. It's the emotion caused by the non-fulfillment of a desire. Okay? So you have, they're both emotions, they're both caused by desires, but one's caused, they're both related to desires, but one's caused by the fulfillment of a desire and the other one's caused by the non-fulfillment. If you go back to my example about the Mercedes, what was creating happiness was all the motives, the desires that were being fulfilled by what you did, and what was causing unhappiness were all the ones that were being non-fulfilled because it didn't happen the way you were expecting. Now, if that is the basic element of emotion, of the emotion happiness, then, as I said before, why don't you just create happiness by picking a whole bunch of desires you can fulfill? Because there's a relationship between the quality of the happiness and the quality of the desire. Fulfillment, non-fulfillment, it's pretty clear. We don't have to talk about, you know, what that is. Either you make it happen or you don't make it happen. One of the things that's very interesting as a result is, in spite of Don Quixote and the musical, impossible dreams, impossible desires are not a very good bet. Because if they're really and truly impossible, improbable is one thing, but impossible is another. If it's really and truly impossible, then there's no way to fulfill a desire, and that means only unhappiness from pursuing something, which is impossible. Now, there's a difference between logically impossible and improbable. You can go see a movie and, you know, if you're young, you can say, geez, I'd like to marry Cameron Diaz. It's improbable. Improbable. But it's not impossible. Now, what would be impossible is if you said, if you went to a movie and you saw a dream sequence in which people were flying. You said, oh, I'd really like to fly. Without an airplane. Without a balloon. Without anything else. I'd just like to float up in the air and fly off. Now, I understand that there are a few people, some places in caves in India, who would, you know, try to do this without any apparatus. But why is it? Another digression. Why is it that we want to fly? Why do we have this desire? Now, I can the getting in the plane and going halfway around the world in a short amount of time, there's a lot of reasons for that. But why is it that we want to float up into the air and drift off? Fly like a bird. A lot of reasons. Everybody's different. Because we think it would give us happiness. Absolutely. And we think it would give us happiness because we have these images that, one, we would be free. Free as a bird. Right? We would be free if we were floating around up in the sky instead of stuck walking on the earth. And so people pursue this thinking. Now, another thing is, it's highly unusual. So if you, for example, could just float up in the room here, you could satisfy the desire to be considered an unusual person of, some spectacular abilities, and therefore everybody would look at you slightly differently than they did before, and that is another reason why people might think that it will create happiness. But what's interesting and is a good example of it, this is an image. Because if you watch birds carefully, they aren't free. Being free as a bird is being imprisoned in fear. Because birds are, if you watch them eating, they're afraid. They're scared to death almost all the time they're eating. They're pecking away and they're looking around, who's going to take this away from me? And this sort of fear is what we're trying to get rid of. And that fear, the constant fear, is what would make us feel free. And of course, that would be great. But that's also part of the avoidance of pain to make things go. So that is another example of, we have a lot of different emotions that we could do along this line. But that is sort of the definition of happiness that I have come to. I have a lot of, I've spent some time writing about this. One of my books, Conversations with Socrates, I wrote, almost 25 years ago. And that's the one where Plato goes to the Isle of Blessed and he talks about all these ideas with Socrates. And the concept is very, very simple. But the application is very complex. And I think that that's exactly what a good concept, what good definitions can do. Because the next question is, what are you going to do about deciding what the quality of your desires are? Now, the third lecture in the series is Intelligent Desiring, and that deals with what the different qualities of desires are and how you can actually have an objective pattern to the quality of your desires. It's not irrelevant what desires you pursue, and it's not irrelevant what the quality is. And where does the quality come from? We're talking about wanting to have happiness all the time. That's what everybody sort of wants. If you had a desire that was continuously fulfilled by its very nature, then you would have a base of happiness all the time. Now, it's not possible to have exactly the same kind of happiness all the time. That would even be boring, after a short amount of time. But it's entirely possible, and a lot of people actually do have this. Just have a base of happiness. It's very simple. It's something that, as long as it's in your control, for example, people who say, I'm going to devote myself to other people in my family or in my community or something like that, and I'm going to try to produce happiness for them. And I know that it's impossible. I mean, they have to realize this. No, it's impossible to do it on a continuous basis, but I can do it. I can make a difference in their life, in their happiness. If you pursue that on a continual basis for one person, two people, three people, four people, ten, the whole community, you will feel the happiness of your endeavor all the time. It sits underneath. And if you feel, for example, confident, which is an emotion we'll talk about next month on the patterns of our emotions, if you feel confident that you are capable of producing some happiness in somebody else, then you pursue this with confidence as well. And having that confidence is also a form of happiness which underlies everything that you do. Now, so that's the defined concept that I have, and then the quality of desires vary in different categories based upon how much control you have over whether they can be fulfilled or not, and how you go about trying to fulfill the desires. And I have six categories that I drop them into, and there are impossible desires. If you want a preview on my website, there is a copy of Intelligent Desiring, one of the essays that I wrote, and you can it's just sitting on the website. So if there are any questions, we can start the question and answer period of the lecture.
Our thanks to George Hammond, author of Conversations with Socrates, for your thought-provoking and informative comments tonight. And now it is time for the question and answer session. we have a lead question that would like to know a little bit more about the Isle of the Blessed. How does this compare with Dante's Limbo?
Well, Dante was a great admirer of philosophers, but of course he was doing it within the Christian tradition, and so he could only admire them so much and not get in trouble. And so what he did was he put the philosophers and Virgil and a few others in the top rung of his limbo. He didn't let them be in the light of God and the experience of heaven, but he put them right there. So he basically borrowed the idea of the Isles of the Blessed several hundred years, 1,500 years later, and described it as the top rung of limbo. But if you ever said to someone who read Dante, well, you know, that actually is the place I'd like to be, to talk with all those guys for the rest of it. If I've got to be someplace for all eternity, hanging around with all those guys would be really quite interesting. That wasn't what he was trying to do, but he did make it look quite attractive.
Are reasonable goals the secret to reasonable happiness?
That's a very good observation, yes. I think that being realistic and reasonable about what you're pursuing is a very big part of life. However, there's something that we resist, if you're an idealist, about being too reasonable. First of all, people want to be passionate, people want to be a little bit wild about some things, be a little bit less than reasonable at times. However, what's interesting about that is if you pursue those kind of desires in a contingent way, a contingent desiring, you can add those pleasures on top of the reasonable ones and not really lose out. It is the California or bus syndrome that brought a lot of people out here. Obviously, a lot of people didn't make it all the way to California. If they came out of California bus and they ended up in Iowa, it could be very disappointing for the rest of their lives. But if they said, California or bus, if I can make it all the way, then if they found something better along the way, they would stop off and, you know, enjoy their place there and not regret the whole time they never got to California. That's what I call contingent desiring. If you pursue big desires contingently, another thing that's absolutely crucial to desire contingently is your relationships with other individuals. One of the things that a lot of idealists don't quite respect strongly enough is the free will of other individuals. First of all, we, as I said before, we all go around sort of asking everybody to be a little different than they are. That already is a slight tweak on their free will, saying, well, I know what you spent all your time creating yourself to be, but I'd like you to be a little different than that. You should have exercised your free will differently than that. But in this case, in addition to the free will, in dealing with another person, you can imagine you meet somebody and you say, it's love at first sight, and you say, I'm going to be happy with this person for the rest of my life, and I just really want to marry that person, and so on and so forth. And you really take in, of course, the whole Snow White and, you know, princess syndrome of the whole thing, and that's in our culture, and you go for it whole hog, and the person says, you know, I really can't stand being with you very often. And you say, no, you have to be with me, because that will make us both very happy. And she says, no, I don't think so. So one of the things that needs to be contingent about this is, you know, you're not really going to be happy if, you know, say you force this person or you convince this person to marry you anyway. And now you're sitting around the table 20 years later and you're still working on it. You know, you come down to breakfast and you're everything you're doing all the time trying to get her to love you. And she says, nah, not yet. You're probably not going to be that happy. Because really what you imagine is, you imagine someone looking at you the same way and saying, oh, I'd be really happy to spend my time with you. And if they're not having a good time spending time with you, it's not satisfying your real desire. Your real desire wasn't that particular person, so much as it was finding somebody who made you realize that you were a source of happiness for somebody else. If you're a source of happiness for somebody else, that's what love is created by. Their love is created by you being a source of happiness for them. And so if you're just a source of irritation for them, they are not going to fall in love with you, even if you do it for 50 years with them. And so if you're contingently desiring them and you say, I'd like to marry you if she's going to find living with me pleasant, then you've got it down, because you know what's going to create happiness both for you and for the other person. This would be very useful in dealing between parents and children as well. But that sort of contingency is also important when you deal with very, very big projects, like, I'd like to rid the world of terrorism. not really likely to take place in the next 10 days. It's not likely to take place as long as people think the way they do about each other, and they've been doing that for a very long time. You know, even when somebody's extremely popular, almost everybody likes him, there's always 10% of the people who don't like him because he's popular with the other 90%. And so that 10% is probably always going to exist as long as jealousy does. And when I describe where jealousy comes from next month, you'll understand why it's not going away real quickly.
We have a very deep thinker in the audience, and I'll try to get through this. Is the atheistic existential world view yet another form of pursuing happiness for its proponents, or is it a separate non-hedonistic philosophy? Is seeking happiness contrary to existentialism?
No, not at all, and I'll tell you why. Because existentialists believe in the despair of this world in a very abstract way. And in order to feel good about themselves, they need to feel the despair of life. And by feeling the despair of life, they feel happy about themselves because they're good people. And therefore, while even Jean-Paul Sartre was happy about being in despair about the world. And I think that this is just a fundamental way that we look at things. We will always do it in a way that makes us feel best. And obviously, the destruction in Europe during the first half of the century was highly influential in being despairing. And if you think, oh, human beings will never make the world a better place, and the human beings have to make the world a better place or I can never be happy, then of course you will be in despair. But there is a possibility that you're happy about being in despair because that does make you feel like a better person, someone who is aware of what's going on. So, yes, an existential atheistic philosophy is not against happiness. It just has a mixed version of it, which, of course, is not the sort of giddy happiness that people think of.
Well, we've come to a point in tonight's program where we have time for one more question. Very interesting and complicated lecture. Could you take 5 minutes to summarize, please?
Sure. It is very complicated. After last summer's sessions, I set up a website with about 100 pages from 10 of the books that I've written that are available for free, anybody that wants to take advantage of that, so that you can have a better idea about some of the more complicated parts of it. But it's very simple in principle. And that is, I think, what's very important to know. I think almost anybody can understand these principles. Applying them is an endless task. If we live forever, it would be there forever for us to do, because it is like an art. If you have these principles, if you have the principles, say, of architecture, or the principles of physics, and then you know what the rules are, and you can apply them in many, 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 many different ways. And everyone can individually do it differently. And that, to me, is what life is. Life is an art, and the art is taking our desires and trying to fulfill them, and doing it as intelligently or as foolishly as we do. We have perfect freedom to be as foolish as possible, and it shows at times. But one of the more foolish desires that many idealists have is, I want to try to remake this whole world to be the way I want it to be. Now, the summary for the 5 minutes is that happiness is the emotion caused by the fulfillment of a desire. Unhappiness is the emotion caused by the non-fulfillment of a desire. That's a nice simple principle. It's complex in application because what's a desire? Desires are all our motives. Desires are all the things we know plus all the motives that sit underneath them. And we have to take all that into account when we're trying to analyze why are we happy, why are we unhappy. The other part of it is that the quality of the desire all by itself and the quality of those motives all by itself fall into different categories and produce either continuous happiness or non-continuous happiness, momentary surges and then despair afterwards, and all those things contribute to our life. And the conclusion in the pursuit of happiness is very simple, and that is, be intelligent about how you desire. Desire is not the root of all suffering. I don't. I think foolish desire is the root of almost all suffering. There is going to be some pain in life no matter what. Things will happen that are outside your control, and no matter what you do, that's going to happen. However, You can have a base of happiness which makes that quite a comfortable experience, something that you would want to go back for again. And anybody who's had some very difficult pain in a relationship or death in the family, that kind of thing, knows that although right at the time it's so painful, you think sometimes, I wish I had never even had this experience before to know what this loss is. But very shortly thereafter, you would never have given up everything that led to the loss. And so it depends upon how much perspective you have all the time. The pain never has to get that strong. When you understand the patterns in the emotions, when you understand desiring and how to pursue your desire, it's very, very clear. And what in the fourth lecture in the series is on the inherent justice of life, and the basic conclusion of that is, you know, we don't need any rewards, we don't need any punishments. Nothing is needed to make life just. Life isn't fair, like everybody said. However, there's a direct correlation between the quality of your desires and the quality of your emotional life, and that's the way that life is inherently just. I was asked to give my website address. It's Pith Press, Pith for Pythagorean, and short, PYTHPRESS.com. If anybody would like to stay after the radio broadcast for more questions, I'm certainly willing to stay and answer more.
You've been listening to a special broadcast of the Commonwealth Club of California, recorded exclusively for the listeners of KALW 91.7 Information Radio in San Francisco. Today's program was recorded on March 3rd. It was the first of four programs presented on the first Monday of each month with our speaker, George Hammond. If you'd like to attend one of the programs in this series, the next will be April 7th at the club office in San Francisco. To better understand our world, ourselves, and our future, this program is made possible by the people of Chevron. Chevron, giving thought to radio and television. If you would like a cassette copy of this program, please call the Commonwealth Club of California at 415-597-6700. For KALW and the Commonwealth Club, I'm Dan Gunning.